Whispers, I am. is all a glory. It sings eternally. There is no other love. The sound of all this master's voice I hear in all prevailing silence, he whispers, I am. Heart is all aglowing, it sings eternally. There is no other love like my master's love. Sweet the sound of all this master's voice I hear in all prevailing silence, he whispers, heart is all aglowing, it sings eternally. There is no other love like my master's love. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. I will never forget thee. I will never forsake thee. I will never forget thee. I will never forsake thee. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. I will never forget thee. I will never forsake thee. I will never forget thee. I will never forsake thee. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. I will never forget thee. I will never forsake thee. I will never forget thee. I will never forsake thee. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. I will never forget thee. I will never forsake thee. I will never forget thee. I will never forsake thee. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. I will never forget thee. I will never forsake thee. I will never forget thee. I will never forsake thee. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. I will never forget thee. I will never forsake thee. I will never forget thee. I will never forsake thee. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. Listen, listen, listen to my heart's song. I will never forget thee, I will never forsake thee, I will never forget thee, I will never forsake thee. Who is in my temple? Who is in my temple? All the doors to open themselves, all the lights to light themselves, all the doors to open themselves, all the lights to light themselves. Darkness like a dark bird flies away, oh flies away. Darkness like a dark bird flies away, oh flies away.
I guess you got lots of questions you want to ask.
Would you talk a little bit about the Satguru, please? Would you talk a little bit about the Satguru?
Satguru. He is the final guru that gives you the last kick into God realization. First, you got to meet all the different gurus who bring you up or prepare you to appreciate what the Satguru is. Satguru is only one who gives you the final blessing. It's like taking your professor emeritus in a university. You see, the true Satguru is a master from the Lord of the soul. And he doesn't tell you that he's a Satguru. And he lives in the world, carries on his ordinary everyday life, and does his business. But in your own nature, after you've searched a long time and done a lot of the meditation, then you are made aware of his existence. And then there's a sudden lighting up inside. And you know that this is the Satguru who will finally give you the last touch to give you the peace profound. So that the peace stays with you now without going away. So in his presence, it's only darshan. There's no education. There is no lectures. It's only constantly reminding you of your nature. And reminding you of looking inside and feeling the presence. In other words, he's going to review everything you learn and make you live it more intensely. So he then gives you his grace and assumes the final karmic bond of making the peace profound in you. So then you are attached to him and you feel the pull inside, and you know that this is the last link in living the bliss. But he makes you realize that he is not the guru, that the real guru is still inside of you. The true eternal guru is yourself. So you have to look inside and you will see him, then finally he will disappear and he will become you. And you will see yourself inside. But then you may not be able to live with the shock of it. So you may cry out, "Give me back my physical guru. I need intimacy." Saint Catherine was the same thing. She didn't want to pray to Jesus. She always wanted to see God, the eternal guru. And more Jesus would appear, but then she would negate the picture. Eventually, when she got the experience, she saw a great, huge, refined version of Saint Catherine, her own self, glowing in this light. And she couldn't take that shock. She said, no, I can't be God. I can't be God. Give me back Jesus. He's more intimate to me. He's more precious to me." And Jesus came back. But then she realized that her own self is the true Satguru. Guru means the spell of the darkness, he who lifts up or she who lifts up. And Sat means the eternal form that lifts up. Lifts up to what? To face yourself. You see, we are not easily able to accept ourselves as a manifestation of God. or that God has become us, which is a total understanding of the experience, that we are not separate from God, and God has become us, and God is passing through each one of us, and we may be separated from Him and may not be able to recognize Him as ourselves working through ourselves. Therefore, we need contact with some other individual who has this understanding, who will coax us, coax the ego, the five senses, away from all type of illusory conditions to accept now some physical form as a sort of a rosette stone or measuring stick. So the physical guru now appears to be that Rosetta Stone or measuring stick, and coaxes you now to gradually come to the realization that God is in you too. So he that do the will of the Lord is my brother and my sister. Sooner or later you will have to do the will of the Lord. And the will of the Lord is to accept where you are, that it's the right place, it's the right time, and the experience is neither good nor bad, but it's the opportunity to test your attitude. Then this finally becomes the true guru, the eternal guru, the guru of living. Because the guru really has no form. The principle that liberates you is guru. This is the true guru. This principle that liberates you from all types of images. Thou shalt have no other gods before me or graven image before me. When the principle is recognized as your own inner self, this is the final freedom. But you have to go in gradations. Now, if I was a cow, I would want a bigger cow to be the guru. If I was a lion, I'd look to a bigger lion for the guru. If I was a tree, I'd look to the biggest tree for a guru. But because I'm a human being, what do I look for? Another human being. This is the empathy level of the personal self. Finally, that very same person breaks us of the illusion or the relationship to look upon our own selves as the guru. But sometimes we can't stand that shock that God has actually become us. So, because when we see ourselves, this may tend to develop superego. So the fear of developing a superego, you want now to remain humble and spiritual, so you say, give me back that thing which that's what you say, love for the alma mater, your school where you came from. You always want to relate to that. So this is why Jesus says, none come unto the Father by me, meaning that after you see yourself, you really want to get back to that divine current in some form, and you relate to it. And that is truly the Satguru, the master who helps you to see yourself. But it is God who actually is doing it for you. We have to use some individual as a sort of a reference point. But even the physical guru can't meditate for you. He can only give you the clues to look at yourself. You have to do the meditation eventually and come out, you see. Now, mother, you say to mother, I'm going to get married and I'm going to have my own children and I have nothing to do with you. Good and fine, go do it yourself. Have all the labor pains and find out what it is to be a mother. So when you have it all and come out, mother, I did it by myself, this is my own children. Good and fine, I'll rear them. You see? The mother can't make the children for you because your own can be, you see? You can only be her child, and your child's got to be your child. Your experience is yours. But the same principle is in both of you and mother. The master is the same thing. We can't go into the master and he can't come into us. We both got to feel the same experience. But we need the reference point. And in that way we understand what the master really represents. He represents the channel to look inside of ourselves. So once we are linked into it by meditation, then we are raised up. And really, in essence, the true guru is love. Love for life. See, God is life. He is the audible life current. That's what they say, in the beginning was the Word, or the audible life current. And the Word was with God. That means it's in the creative principle. And the word was God or is God. So that is the actual true guru. And the word was made flesh, animal and man, but then it differentiated, it rested in man, and the word remained in man, you see. So man must make the final confrontation or experience with this audible current inside of himself. He must learn to trust. In simple language, you must take your mind, which is your five senses and your subconscious thinking, and begin to trust your conscience, which is God inside of you. You see, we didn't want to admit before that God is our conscience, and he's constantly watching us in the form of conscience. But when we begin to view it in layman's term, strictly, God is our divine conscience, inherent in the life principle, that is directing every movement within us. And our consciousness, which is searching for all type of experience, has to come back and line up with it and become one. So your consciousness and your conscience have to act as one. Now, your consciousness can assume many things about what the divine life is. But anytime you go to try to act it, the decision is made by your conscience. And whenever you act it, it's only your conscience you have to account for. Now you have had this experience over and over from the time you're growing up to now, to really look at it objectively and try to live with it. You see? So in essence and in simplicity, it is the constant facing your conscience with your consciousness. And that is true Sat, eternal Guru. Lifting up, or dispeller of the darkness. This is the eternal lifting up force that dispels all doubt, the conscience that decides to act through your body. You live with that, and to that you account to all the time. Now, we don't have a soul to save, we have a soul to realize. So the soul being the totalness of our nature, we have to realize how the conscience works through us to direct our consciousness, which is our ego, which is our personality. The conscience is the Christ in you. It's the deliverer. It's the Satguru. It's the eternal self that acts within you to make you face yourself, which is your five senses or your personality. You begin to live it now in simple terms, without any complex conditions or without any fear. You can now live with this, with yourself. See? Because for the first time, you are really looking at yourself. Now, and as you think, that is what you become. As the consciousness puts up an idea or a thought, the conscience takes it and acts it out. So energy follows every thought we release, and the energy is released by the conscience, and the thought is in the consciousness, that is the five senses, the subconscious memory of relating, and the conscience is the final decision to act. You see, you can say to me, tomorrow morning you're going to have a banana for breakfast. That's in your consciousness. But you're not eating the banana until tomorrow, which is your conscience. By the time you get to the point where you can actually eat the banana or eat some cheese, this is still your consciousness. When you make the final act of peeling the banana and putting it in your mouth, that's your conscience. Until that last minute of action, it's called the moment of truth. It is between the conscience and the consciousness. And Guru, or Divine Self, is conscience. Divine nature or divine thinking is consciousness. You see, now you understand why Jesus says you become like a child, because of its simplicity. It's in that simple approach, that simple alignment, you are free eternally now, free man or lord of yourself. So the guru is not just a person physically. This is what Jesus is trying to break us from the personality of the duality of the consciousness and perceive the true guru, the true meaning of the guru or messiah, the true principle that lifts us up. See, messiah, guru all means lift up or dispeller of ignorance. The thing that lifts you up, and the only thing that lifts you up as a person, is your conscience. Because if you see another person, your conscience may assume that he is a spiritual person. But it's your conscience that got to decide if he is really a spiritual person for you or for somebody else. And it's got to decide if you want to live that way, how they live. So the action is always going to be determined by your conscience. And that is the true guru. Because that is the one that you have to live with. That's the one that you got to look and feel all the time.
One more question, please.
All right.
What is the purpose of a guru giving a disciple an Indian name? What exactly? Can you explain it?
We expect a change of personality by having something different than what we've been called in order to relate to. So when we enter the behavior pattern of being spiritual, we don't like to relate to our old self because our old self don't have any true meaning for us. We want something different in terms of our spiritual self. So if we are given a name to represent something spiritual, it will help us to disassociate from our old behavior patterns and accept a new behavior pattern. All right, for example, we take that four-wheel object outside there with tires and there's a big square box, and we call it a Model T. But we weren't content to call it a Model T, we call it motor car. But then motor car don't seem to be an appropriate name, we call it vehicle. But the vehicle don't seem to be appropriate, so we call it automobile. Have we really changed anything?
No.
But what we have done to it? We have improved our relationship with it by the various names we gave it. And by virtue of that, we have made a more intimate relationship with the object. But the object primarily is designed to do what? Transport you like a carriage. Mm. You understand? So the new name is to establish a more intimacy with the vital power in your body. So if you were called Joan when you were born, that doesn't seem to give you much intimacy, and at a later date you meet some spiritual person who may call you Sarada, which means faithful, one with faith, one with great conviction. He might as well call you Faith Smith. If your mother called you Faith Smith, if your last name is Smith and then your first name is Faith, they don't mean anything to you. The word faith in English didn't mean anything because it didn't leave an impression. Mm. But now he comes along and gives you a Sanskrit name, Sraddha, which means faith or faithful. It rings a bell, it sounds good inside. It resonates, you see. So then he puts another word in front of it, Sister Sraddha or Sraddha G. The G is a little more reverence, reverend sister. You see, all these terms tend to bring endearment. It's like my own name. They could have called me Swami Adano, but because he didn't want to call me that, he called me Nityananda, meaning ever new bliss, and I switched it and called it Nitty Gritty. It's more appropriate to what I would feel to myself. You understand? Somehow names tend to bring out a little more intimacy of how you feel. Like Dayamata, her name is Faye Wright. Now she, Daya means compassion, you see, Mata means mother. And she was a very compassionate girl before she ever met Yogananda. She was raised as a Mormon and was very, very outgoing and very interested in people as a whole, and began to study and meditate and stayed in the retreat. And finally, the fullness of that quality of compassion extended to every part of life around that ashram. So Master only changed her name instead of her compassionate right, he called her Dayamata, right? Mother of compassion. The yogic name does not imply something different. It implies a quality to which you personally seem to vibrate at. That quality that you vibrate at, they give you that name because that stands out in your life. This is the quality you seem to generate. So the spiritual teachers just emphasize it by giving it a Sanskrit name. Or it's holiness. See? Now, Sri Yukteswar. Yukteswar means Lion of God. No, in other words, when he gets up to talk about God, he roars. he takes no double talk from anybody about what God is. He's going to make sure you accept him or not. And Sri, if you put the S in front of the I in front of the R, is Sir Lion of God. Sri only means Reverend. You understand? Or Mr. God. So Sri is just an endearment. Or reverend, it means reverend, you see, it's another word for reverend. And Parahamsa Yogananda is the same thing, you see. His name was Mukundalal Ghosh. And he could well be called Mukundalal Ghosh or Reverend Mukundalal Ghosh. But it wasn't appropriate for a Hindu to be called reverend unless he was in a Christian ministry, where they have lots of Indians who are Christian and they have the word reverend in front of their name. So his teachers merely called him Parahamsa. Paraham means the Hamsa is a swan. Para means divine swan. Mm. One who has lifted himself up into that divine state and is staying unruffled from the pull of the environment. And Yogananda, bliss through the union with God. So if you feel when you meditate some quality that Mukundalal Ghosh, and he could well be called Mukundalal Ghosh or Reverend Mukundalal Ghosh, but it wasn't appropriate for a Hindu to be called Reverend unless he was in a Christian ministry, where they have lots of Indians who are Christian and they have the word Reverend in front of their name. So his teachers merely called him Parahamsa. Paraham means the Hamsa is a swan. Para means divine swan. One who has lifted himself up in that divine state and is staying unruffled from the pull of the environment. And Yogananda, bliss through the union with God. So if you feel when you meditate some quality that goes out of you, that quality is your true spiritual name, because that is what you really are. You should I believe that a person should be given a name at a certain time of their life to describe their spiritual quality. And that should be their actual name from then on as they take it. Because that is what they really express. That is their character, that's their personality. And they are vibrating at that frequency. So they are an example of that particular aspect of God. See, the name is an aspect of life and a certain behavior aspect of life. So compassion, grace, love, wisdom, ever-newness, all these are different aspects. Now the highest aspect of God is Adi, which means first joy. Well, no human being can be called the first joy. It's not right to call a human being the first joy, because God is the only first joy, because everything has to originate from him. So we say Adi Ananda, he is the first joy, the first thing everyone wants to achieve. And then the next level from first joy is ever new joy. See, Anand Swami, who was going to name me, he was going to name me Adi Ananda from my name Adano. But he says, no, I can't call you Adi Ananda because God is the first joy, you ain't God. God became you, so you call it Nityananda, which is you have a new joy. And then I said to myself, I prefer it because it represents me more, nitty gritty. I get a joy out of pinpointing things. So a spiritual name is more of an indication of a quality or an aspect in which you are vibrating from. Now, like Muktananda. Mukta means liberated, Ananda means bliss. Bliss through liberation, or the joy of being liberated. If one feels joyful from being liberated from all the desire nature. So knowing that you don't have no more desires, you feel joyful. So he felt so happy when he came to the realization that he didn't crave nothing in this world. He said, Muktananda.
But these names that you speak of seem to be given at the time when the disciple has attained.
Yes, when he has wrung it out in his nature, that particular aspect which he feels totally at home with or one with. Okay, right. Yeah, I can use one of that. When the individual feels totally at home with some aspect, well, you take the Indians on the reservation. They have a similar way, it's what they call the naming of the child. They don't give it a name. He's called boy and girl until they reach 13 years of age, unless they have to record themselves in the Indian schools for the sake of recording, then they have a name from their family line, which they are doing now because of the compulsory school requiring them to have a name. But the Indians originally would not name the child. At the age of 13, they were sent out on their own. It's what they call coming of age. And they go away for 3 days. And then they come back. When they went out, they were given a bow and an arrow to go and survive on the reservation. And then they will return, and when they return, after they survive the 3 days, the ordeal of being by themselves, that what they brought back as evidence of their ability to survive the 3 days on their own, that was the name they were given, or the experience that they encountered. Well, for instance, the boy is 13 years of age and he goes out, it's a bright sunny day, bow and arrow. First day, he sees nothing, empty reservation, not even a squirrel, not even a gopher. Lots of sunshine, nothing unusual. Second day, after sleeping all night, he wakes up in the morning and the rain starts to fall on his face. Next day, nothing else happened. The third day, he may see some little bird and he catches the bird. If he's lucky, catch the bird and eat it. When he comes back, then they ask him, well, what did you experience? So he says, well, the second day rain fall on me in my face when I got out of the hole where I was staying. So the chief says, rain in the face. That's your name. Rain, that's the first actual tangible experience. So from then on he's called rain in the face. He's not called from capturing the bird, because that's a secondary experience for surviving. But the first experience that was unusual to everything, that would be called. Now if he saw a grey wolf or a fox, he tried to hunt it down and he was lucky to catch it or do anything, then he would be named after that. Or he would learn the ways of the animal. He would study the animals for the 3 days and observe their ways. Then he would be called that name. They give themselves. So Chief Grey Wolf, you hear someone is called Chief Grey Wolf, he has found the affinity with the grey wolf and its behavior. And he would have the ability to call that wolf to him, or any kind of a grey wolf towards him, by a certain grunting noise that he had learnt, and the animal will come to him. Now it won't go to any other body. It will tear the other person up to pieces, but it will come to this person because they have formed what is called an alliance or a unity with life. They didn't go out to kill the animal, they came to find an alliance, a unity with life. And they only kill to eat, to survive. And they pray before they kill, and after they kill, they pray for the life of the creature that they have to take. So it's a naming ceremony in itself, and It's an alliance principle or a reverence for life. So that creature that they are named or take the name from, they have a bond with. Now you take the Agoma Indians, most of them are, they have a name that represents the rattler. So some are called Agoma Chi, or Chi Agoma, or Chichi Agoma. That Chi is a snake, you see, or rattler. So all the Indians will dance, and you can take rattlesnakes and throw them down on the ground. And many Indians will dance, but they dare not pick up the rattler. And the Agoma Indian will come along, and he will say, Agoma Chi, Agoma Chi Chi Chi, or all different ways of saying this Chi. And the snake will look up at him and hissle, and then he will go up and pick up the snake, wrap him around his neck and dance. But no other one can do it, because anyone does it, the snake will bite them. The snake and the Agoma Indian, the boy, when he was growing up, had made an alliance together. And the sons that they make, that they are friends, they are allies, they are not killing each other. And he can reach up that deadly rattler, you understand, that snake, and pick him up, and wrap him all around and dance. And then put him down. Now I've seen this in sometimes these shows, the rodeos, you know. These Agoma Indians will come out and they snake dance. And they would have other Indians which would say, oh, there's nothing to this Agoma dance. And a lot of half Cherokees and half Choctaws and different, who says, oh, it's all, well, you see, you gotta love the creature, or you gotta have faith. Phooey. Many of them get bit by the snake. And sometimes it's very tragic too, when you begin to see that they try to pick up the rattler and the rattler will strike at them with all of this, the way of saying. And yet the Agoma Indian will come along and chant this particular sound, and the rattler will calm itself and look at them as if they are blood brothers. And he'll just stretch up his hand, he wouldn't strike, he'll pick it up, put it over his neck and dance, and then put it back down. And they'll, so we know that the Indians, in their own way, had different ways of establishing a unity with the creation or the life forms, and therefore they took their names after that form to which they had the alliance with. Now, the Hindu Indians, they took the names in terms of the qualities in their nature, in terms like charity, love, wisdom, or faith, compassion, from the quality to which they felt attuned to, they took that name. Now in the Catholic Church, they do have a similar thing. They always have a name taken after Mary or Joseph or one of the saints. So they have some other name to that. And then they call them brother and sister. But the naming is very good because it does establish some kind of a relationship. Well, I have a friend of mine who has two children, two boys. And the first boy, he called me and asked me what should he call his son when his son was born. And I said, call him Sadananda. Sadananda means disciplined one. Somebody who follows discipline, the sadhana, you see. And for sure, very disciplined, this boy. He's got all the makings of a good student who will discipline his mind. But the second son, he dreams two nights before he ever had a relationship with his wife that he's going to have a son. And the son appears in this dream and tells him his name. And he says, now, I'm coming in as your son now. So he tells his wife that they're going to have a child, it's going to be a boy. She says, come on, you're kidding. He says, you'll see. And when he's born, I can tell you his name. So she got pregnant, and before he was born, he told her the name. And when the boy was born, as a baby boy, they give him the name right away, and the baby, yeah, and he shakes his hands. As he starts to recognize that it was funny. So both hands he shook and he held on to her, and he never cried after that. So sometimes these are
I've been told that the soul, incarnating soul, does impress upon the mother often what the name should be.
If it's evolved enough, it can do that.
I see. So this would not be in all cases?
No. If it's evolved enough, it will tell them what they should call it, because it knows its true name, and it knows its purpose in life, and it comes back. You see, that was the same of Jesus. He's supposed to have been called Emmanuel. But they never call him Emmanuel because they didn't believe it at the time. So they had a problem naming him. And when the three wise men came in, they were busy debating either to call him Abi, Sammy, or Ike. But just then, Balthazar, the big tall one, bumped his head on the cross beam of the manger. He says, "Jesus Christ, this has a good name." You should have been called Emmanuel, you see, that was his real name, because that's what the angel told Mary to call him, you see. But she didn't call him that, and now we end up with a name that has got everybody confused, because Jesus is not a Jewish name, you see. It's actually a non-Jew name. And the only thing that came close to the word Jesus was the word Isa, or Isu. But this, even Isu was not fully Jewish. Isa would be a truly Jewish, I-S-A, or Hebrew, you see. But it was the word Jesus was not, you see. And that is what was. That's why many people contest the fact if he was a real man or he have actually lived, because it doesn't fit the Jewish pattern of naming a child. And again, the word Joseph, it's an abbreviation, because really Jewish people never named their children Joseph. It's either Josephus or Jositus, you see. It's got to be something, or Solomon, or some other way of saying the name. It never really comes out the way we pronounce it in English. So that makes it a little difficult for most Jewish people to accept that they believe that Jesus ever really did live, let alone come from their lineage. So this is brought on strictly because of the Greek translators, who could not translate fully from Hebrew into Greek, into Latin, let alone down into English. The changing of its original tone began, you see. And Christ, again, was the Greek word for anointed, or God in man, you see. And therefore, again, that threw off a great deal of misunderstanding for the Jewish people to comprehend or accept Jesus as their realized master. But those who were living in the Orient and understand the guru-disciple relationship and understand the Krishna principle or the Christ principle, they are the ones, those Orientals accept Jesus as a Christ realized master. That came, he was the first of the lineage in the genes of the Jews to ever have that experience of fully Christ realized in that genetics lineage. You see, in the Middle East, because they've had other realized masters in the Far East, but he was the first of his lineage in that environment. Therefore, he said he was the first of divine, the first fruit of divine of that particular lineage. The Christ intelligence is the universal principle or personal Godhead, which everyone strives to realize in order to become fully God-realized. We have to get to that state first, you see. We have to go from the ego level to the Christ level. And then once we're in the Christ level, then we can be fully God-realized. So Jesus was in that state. That's why he asked Peter, "Who do men say that I am?" Well, the other disciples couldn't recognize it because they didn't have the inner experience. But Peter raised his mind by being steady or calm and looked at his teacher and said, "Thou art Christ." But then he said, "I didn't tell you that." What Peter meant by using the word Christos in the Greek translation meant, "Thou art the anointed," or "Thou is the enlightened." Because his Christ intelligence or his enlightenment was perceiving the full enlightenment embodied in the man Jesus. That's why Jesus told him, "I didn't tell you that, but the Father which is in you," that's the vital power which is in you, "reveal it to you, brought your consciousness up to the point where your brain could perceive it, flowing in me as Jesus, fully flowing." Then he says, upon this rock, upon this concrete experience, I will build my church, that is a temple. I'll let you start a lineage of Christ-realized people who were able to raise their consciousness to look upon their own Christ nature. But later on, he realized that Peter was not fully evolved in that state. Therefore, he told him he would betray. People thought he would betray the master because he was afraid to admit that he knew Jesus. Jesus was not referring to that betrayal. He was referring to the experience that Peter had, that when he was challenged in his own nature of fear, he would doubt that he ever had such an experience, because he was never confirmed from any other source except the man Jesus who said to him, experience. And if he did have this kind of experience, how come he couldn't block the Romans? You see, why would the teacher stop him from raising the sword and cutting off the other guy's ears? You see, he did that, and he realized that all these things might have been mental hallucinations, that he really wasn't that evolved, or the experiences were not genuine. So in his own fear, he withdrew and went into a sort of mental dilemma or depression. See, we all go through that. We all live through the Peter consciousness, we live through the Judas consciousness, we live through the Thomas consciousness, we live through the John consciousness, and all the other disciples. We live out what is called the 12 levels of behavior of a disciple, which is the 12 signs of the zodiac. We live that out in viewing the inner nature.
Are you implying in what you just said that each of the 12 disciples was most closely associated with a particular sign of the zodiac?
Yeah. You see, the master had to select them. Remember, I chose you, didn't choose me. You know? He being the central sun, a representation of the cosmic light in the body. That's why he said, I am the light of the world while I'm in the world. So his major disciples who would play the drama would have to be drawn from the 12 signs of the zodiac. Every aspect has to be fulfilled. He can't condemn or tear down. He has to fulfill them in many subtle ways. And therefore, we only have 12 types of behaviors in the 12 classifications of men from their 12 signs of the zodiac. And each one had to relate and behave a certain way in union with the divine light or the Christ principle. So he drew them onto him, and each one was a representation by their behavior of that particular quality. Now, we have that same thing in the chakras. We have 6 chakras below the 7th one, which is the Christ chakra. And this is 6 in polarity, meaning a downward pole and an upward pole, which is the 12 disciples. So the downward pole means they move this way, and the upward pole means they pulled up this way. Now, downward didn't mean bad, and upward didn't mean better. It meant that the movements were making it a cyclic pattern inside the body around this central sun, and as they were pulled down, they would be the first ones to deny the possibility of ever having the experience, and they would be the ones that would never have the experience first. They would have the experience last. Those who were pulling up, those would be the one who would having the experience first in order, and they would be coming closer to the light. So Peter was the one closest to the light in the movement of the inner bodies. So he was the first one to recognize it in the Master Jesus in the 12 movements. And they came in that order. First it was Peter, then John, then James, and then Philip. All the rung in that movement. As the ignorance faded away from their consciousness, in that inner movement, they were able to perceive the Christ intelligence in themselves. So one can see which disciples were the most advanced disciples, were the ones who were closest to the Christ nature in themselves. In the case of John, he was called the Beloved because he was able to perceive the chakras better and clearer, intimately, more than the rest. Therefore, he was allowed to write about the chakra in the Book of Revelations. On the science of the soul, simply because he not polluted by the thought patterns of the environment. He was more in alliance and he was the youngest, so the master poured more into him. And he was a student of more devotion than all of the rest. That's why when he was leaving the body, he singled him out to say, "Mother, behold your son, son, behold your mother." In other words, the bond was so great in devotion that Jesus couldn't find anyone in the 12 to equal the devotion of loving God as mother in creation. You see, we don't have father nature, it's mother nature. And the son would have to go on to the father and leave the mother aspect of manifestation, but it'd have to replace some tangible symbol for consolation. So in his 12 disciples with the highest devotion, John was the outstanding one. Peter was outstanding in volition, in willpower, in initiating action, but very, very haphazard in discipline, because he never stuck to his discipline, you see. Whereas John was very devoted, and out of the devotion, John was then say, "Son, behold your mother, mother, behold your son." The two of you now will act as one. There's a laying the foundation for the rest of the relator. That's why he could never call his mother, mother. You see, because it was God in human form, in the female aspect, so he called her woman. His only love was the father, which was outside of the creation. Knowing this, he went on to his own higher self and then transferred the allegiance to the next disciple in line with the most devotion. So John, the beloved, as he's called, was given the custody of that commitment or relationship. And the mother was able to relate to now. She could see the bond, that he was just as spiritually attuned as our true son in the flesh, but he would go further to have the writings of the knowledge of the and put it down on paper.
I wonder if you could say something about duty. In reading many of the books that I've been reading since you were here last, it talks about though you are on the path and on your way home, you must still while here do your duty. And there seem to be implications that this means that your duty is still what it has always been, and you must keep doing what you always have done. And yet one seems to have desires to change what he is doing, to for example get out of the rat race and get into something more peaceful, and something that is now more enjoyable. But the book seems to give the feeling that you shouldn't do this, that you must stay with what you were doing before and stay in the rat race or whatever the situation may be and continue on.
Sanatana Dharma. That's the term they use in Sanskrit. Or Dainalata task. Krishna said to Arjuna, "Do thine allotted task. Perform thy duty, Sanatana Dharma, or the eternal action." Jesus called it, "He that do the will of the Lord is my brother and my sister." Duty is divine will. Now, divine will helps us to live through every situation in our environment without negating it or praising it. Because divine will is simply this type of behavior. To accept where you are as the right place, the right time, and that the experience you're encountering is neither good nor bad. It's just the opportunity to test your attitude. And this is duty personified in essence. Therefore, you don't have no thought of recrimination or guilt anymore. You act it out because it's divine law. And it's unimportant what the job is. The important thing is how you behave while you're doing it. And this is truly what duty is. Now, for instance, if a governor or a president commands you to go into battlefield and do your duty, he carries the karma, not you. You're only fulfilling his particular desire, nature to to correct a certain principle in the environment, you, having no desire to kill, you go into the battle and leave the divine law of God to take care of you, to bring you out without a scar. If you have a desire to kill and you went in simply because you commanded to go and you're vindictive in consciousness, then you might be killed. But if you don't have a desire to kill and the duty requires that you go in because you're born within a certain environment for a certain national karmic relationship because of certain internal unfulfilled thought patterns, you will go through that experience without being hurt and come out. You see, you have a national duty and an individual duty. So it's environmental and individual. Now, I've had many student friends of mine who had gone through the same situation. One day, a young man went to Yogananda, and Yogananda was in the body. And he said to him, I don't want to go to Korea because I want to be a conscientious objector. And Yogananda said to him, I can't stop the American government from fighting the Korean government. Neither can stop the Korean government from fighting the Americans. But you go in and do your duty as an American since you're born in this karmic makeup, and see what God will do for you. If you have any desire to kill or if you have no desire to kill, you go in. Do your duty. The boy says, I have no desire to kill. He says, okay, go in. Face the situation of going through the process. He went in through his basic training, and lo and behold, he never left the shores of California for Korea because he was made a Signal Corps and stuck out in San Francisco for the duration of the time. What the God force will do for you in your own personal karma is more important than the fear of the collective karma to which you are going to find yourself in. But you must face the situation to find out if your karma is involved with taking life or your karma is merely to pass through as an innocent bystander and observer in the process of the motion. And those who have to actually kill or be killed, they must go on to complete their karma. Excuse me for a second. But think of what I said and you'll see what happens.
Now, so the consciousness of the outside world suddenly begins to dissipate, diminish, and we find now all our desire making, all our attachments, all our so-called hang-ups falling off bit by bit. And all our evolution is speeded up for the first time. We begin to experience the sense of unity, sense of oneness, sense of beingness. Meditation is a daily process of freeing the body from these tensions that build up to the consciousness, the various shocks that impose upon the body by the environment in the form of disease. We're supposed to be living in an inner harmony, an inner peace. And if we do that, that is when the conscience is lined up. Health flows normally, naturally. If we are not, then our consciousness is in a state of agitation and it's carrying over all the thoughts and feelings from our environment and from our feelings. And we think we are living our own lives. We believe we're living our own lives. But so few live their own lives. Most of us are living beyond faith, thought patterns, the suppressed thought patterns of the feelings. Many such ways, not to the beast of himself. Some of it are removed at certain points, but there are certain residues that are from this point. We still have to work it out, play it up, before we can actually Bhagavad-gita. The inner harmony of the conscience is health. You never hear the word guilty consciousness. You always hear the word guilty conscience. Person suffering from a guilty conscience, not from a guilty consciousness. Because consciousness is dualistic. It flows out, it flows in. It's not concerned with stability, more concerned with assumptiveness. It's only with a conscience you can find the stability of reality. But since you don't know too much about conscience, that is, the consciousness is not fully aware of the conscience and how it operates, then the consciousness lives in a state of semi-fear, semi-anxiety, because it is not secure. If the consciousness was secure by virtue of any type of training, it would trust the conscience. But because it doesn't have that kind of training or that kind of encouragement from the environment or from its own programming or education, it doesn't trust the conscience. Therefore, it tries to set itself apart. It tries to separate itself by making itself important in terms of behavior. Then we find that we're in dire conflict with our own conscience. When the conscience is not to release power and give us that state of illumination that we're looking for. Then the Master Jesus said, as many as receive Him, to them gave He the power to become the sons of God. In essence, He was saying, as many individuals whose consciousness would let go of the environment and accept their conscience, which is their Him in themselves, or their vital spark, the eternal principle of nature, and that conscience is accepted as their sole reality, the bridge between the being and the God self, the divine life, they would automatically transcend or become the sun with light or lumen. You will feel the sense of enlightenment. There will be a sudden internal change for harmony, balance, and perfection. That balance, that flow, will come on instantaneously. And some people, it comes on so instantly that it's dramatic. In others, it comes on that. But however it comes on, from the content, there is that glow, there is that joy, there is that luminosity, that love, and that internal freedom of life, the sense of being. We can bring this about by feeding it up to certain internal approaches. By meditation, we can prepare the mind to withstand the shock of the release in the conscience. And in meditation, there are times when your conscience lets go and wash out all the negative thoughts, residues in your consciousness. And suddenly you find yourself wanting to cry, wanting to groan, wanting to yawn, wanting to stretch, twist or turn. And suddenly you find yourself. These are all indications that the conscience is finally being recognized as the sole bridge between the being and the God self, between the individual and the other person. Since we don't have a soul and we are soul, then conscience is the real guy. It's the real bridge that helps us to access the reality of our nature. And to what level we are ascending inside. Our Sankhan helps us to ascend the first level of internal experience, which is matter, essence of matter. And we begin to hear the other life currents inside of ourselves. They vary for each one of us as to the degree of the receptivity. Sometimes you'll hear the beat, the heart, trumpet, conch shell, the drum beat, the bell, the roar of the ocean. On the flat. And finally you may hear the bagpipes blowing. And all of it will gradually become a symphony. As your symphony begins to play inside of you, in that conscience, you are becoming realized. You're stepping out of the full of your consciousness. And Jesus was in the body, he said, I saw Satan fall from heaven like a light. That is to say, the conscience perceives consciousness emanating out from the God self as a light energy. And Satan is a part of light. Consciousness is realistic, phenomenal. This light energy is absorbed observed in our environment as a dualistic principle. It can be measured as a wave, it can be measured as a property. And therefore there is no permanency and reality in light. And God is not light, but God is sound. Therefore the Christ intelligence or the conscience is indicating that we can trust our consciousness is determined existence by light. We use the consciousness through our five senses to guide ourselves around in our environment, created out of light, congealed as light, congealed in the form of matter. It is light. And this is a direct opposition, Satan means adversary, the word means adversary, direct opposition to the sun current. It commands, corrects, dominates, and regulate our universe and give us the inner peace. As our conscience becomes steady and centered on the autonomic frequency within our being, then we are completely aligned with spirit and we are liberated. We are liberated from the assumptive nature, the desire nature that tends to tear us down as we look outside the five senses into the world of perception. The more we meditate and look inside and relate to the content, the more the content will guide us without the need of the five senses. So when Jesus said, if the Son of Man be lifted up, I'll draw all men unto me. If the consciousness, it is realistic, it is the result of the procreated act of evil nature, it raised up to the conscience, then the conscience will draw it back into the God self, the pure, unrealized thing. And the basis of our meditation is to bring this about, that this consciousness can line itself up to the conscience, so it can synchronize with the orderly life form within the meditation. And the experience is illumination, enlightenment, or oneness. And we are all connected in life. There is no such thing as being separated, only in the consciousness of separation exists. And at best, consciousness is only put to the point when you're from the street and you don't know who you are. That is objective energy. But conscience will always be with you even when you leave this frame, because that is what you have actually done with yourself. And no one is going to believe in for it. And you can't blame no one for having done anything. You only blame yourself. It's a funny question. There's no something for nothing in this universe. You gotta know. That's what God really is. Learning to love. It's insecurity. And being secure in it. With the insecurity, security. You got no guarantee that you can do anything for you until you live it. And then you live it, you got to follow your conscience and not your conscience. Any action you make in this world of manifestation will be judged upon your conscience and not your conscience. Therefore, there is no condemnation in the creative principle, God. You cannot condemn yourself in your action. Only unto the Son, the Spirit, the conscience, is judgment. And judgment is not punishment. Condemnation is not separation. If there is no condemnation in the audible life stream, then we can't be separated from him. We connect to him all through eternity, in spite of our ridiculous behavior to our consciousness. And our conscience is going to judge us, but our conscience is not going to penalize us. It's only our consciousness is going to penalize us, the very same thing that created the problem. Your consciousness is going to make you come back to basics. And that's what the reincarnation is all about. Your God back to face your consciousness. Children who fail to pass their grade go home and mumble to daddy and mommy. Mommy and daddy may get upset. Give them a good school. The school is not going to change their policy. You didn't pass the grade, and you know you didn't do it, but the consequences will come back and do it next year. And that is the real thing of trouble. Consciousness, conscience, out of your life. Infinity. And as simple a way you could ever look at it. You can also call it Father's Son, or the state of intelligence, the Christ Son, or the opposition, Satan. There's no question. It's just to deal with the consciousness. God is not light. God is Son. In the beginning of the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word is God, or was God, and the Word is with God, and so is man. But let there be light. And out of light came creation, a feeling of Maya. The English terminology for a word.